Local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, election season is here and early voting in New York kicks off October 25th. To help residents get ready for the polls, Radio Catskill's Patricia Rubio spoke with Ulster County Board of Elections Commissioners Ashley Torres and John Quigley. They discuss what it takes to run a smooth election, from testing voting machines and training more than 650 inspectors to managing absentee ballots. Also coming up, we've got a report from Congressman Josh Rowley's town hall on Monday, where he faced questions about health care, foreign policy, and local utility costs. Kimberly Izar was there. Hispanic Heritage Month, we speak with award-winning journalist Maria Hinojosa of Latino USA, and community members taking time just to talk to one another. That's after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Former FBI Director James Comey is scheduled to be arraigned this hour in Virginia. He faces two federal counts for allegedly making a false statement to Congress and interfering in a congressional investigation. Comey has maintained his innocence. He's also a critic of President Trump, who has been demanding that Comey be prosecuted. NPR's Kerry Johnson says Trump's repeated insults of Comey could play a role in any trial.
Donald Trump will not be in the courtroom, but he could be a main character, especially if Comey and his lawyer decide to make an argument about selective or vindictive prosecution, basically that Comey would not have been prosecuted except for Trump's antagonism. The president's own words on social media and video could help advance that argument.
NPR's Kerry Johnson reporting. This is day 8 of the federal government shutdown. Democrats and Republicans need to agree on a spending bill to end it, and no agreement is in sight. This means federal government workers are being furloughed. Some essential workers, such as air traffic controllers, are on the job without pay. But a new White House memo is raising questions about whether these workers will get back pay when the shutdown is over. From member station WAMU, Jenny Abamu has more.
The White House is making the case that hundreds of thousands of furloughed federal workers are not automatically guaranteed back pay. The memo seeks to reinterpret a 2019 law passed during Trump's first term to protect furloughed workers, like Sarah Coburn at the National Institutes of Health. She still wants Democrats to hold the line.
Am I afraid of that consequence? Yeah, of course. I have, you know, dependents and a house and a mortgage and all those things, but I can't invest in every threat or I wouldn't survive it.
Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen helped write the 2019 back pay law. He says the statute is clear and, quote, there's nothing the administration can do to change that. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Abamu.
Stocks opened mixed this morning as the World Trade Organization raised its forecast for international commerce. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped about 13 points in early trading.
The WTO expects global goods trade to grow by 2.4% this year, more than twice as fast as it had been projecting just a couple months ago. That's partly thanks to robust trade in computer chips and other products tied to artificial intelligence. Tesla is rolling out cheaper models of two of its electric vehicles. The Model Y and Model 3 will both list for under $40,000. Tesla's trying to recharge sales, which have been hurt by increased competition and political backlash to CEO Elon Musk. And gold prices continue to sparkle. After topping $4,000 an ounce this week for the first time ever, gold continues to see strong demand from anxious investors seeking a safe haven. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down about 6 points. You're listening to NPR. High-level talks opened today in Egypt to try to end the war in Gaza. President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, will be there. So will his envoy, Steve Witkoff. Qatar's prime minister will also join. Hamas negotiators say they're seeking guarantees from the U.S. that if they release hostages, Israel will put a final end to the war. President Emmanuel Macron is searching for a way out of France's political crisis. He's trying to avoid dissolving the French parliament and calling fresh legislative elections. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports Macron told his outgoing prime minister, who resigned Monday, to find a last-minute agreement among the divided political parties.
Political scientist Corinne Meloul says France's Fifth Republic has a two-round voting system meant to elect one majority party, that of the president, which then governs. But she says it's no longer working in France's increasingly fragmented political landscape, where there is no majority in agreement in the center and the largest voting blocs are on the right and left extremes.
The two do not work together. There's no political culture of compromise, like Nordic countries, Italy, Germany, where you have coalition governments. It's the only way to put a government together.
In France, she says, governing with a coalition is not in the political culture. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Three scientists have won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry today. Susumu Kitagawa, Richard Robson, and Omar Yagi are being honored for research showing how molecules can be built into structures. These structures could lead to the creation of new materials. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Residents from across New York's 19th congressional district, from Sullivan to Chenango counties, attended Representative Josh Riley's Monday town hall on rural health care at SUNY Sullivan. Riley said he has long opposed President Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill, which could cut health coverage for 1.5 million New Yorkers. But some attendees came and left feeling skeptical. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar was there and has this report. And we should note the audio in this segment was digitally enhanced for clarity.
New York Congressmember Josh Riley visited Sullivan County on Monday evening to discuss how to keep health care close to home. Riley criticized lawmakers backing the One Big Beautiful Bill's health care cuts as the federal government enters its second week of a federal shutdown.
In Washington, a whole bunch of politicians are pushing legislation that is going to take $1 trillion out of the public health system, all to give tax breaks to Wall Street and folks who don't need it, and take a perilous situation for healthcare in our rural communities and make it even worse. Or we can do what all of us here are committed to do, and I know all of you are committed to doing together, which is make sure folks can get access to the healthcare they need. How simple is that?
About 100 people attended the town hall at SUNY Sullivan in Loch Sheldrick, where Riley says he's committed to making sure folks get the health care they need. He was joined by local health care and community leaders who shared about the challenges navigating health care in rural New York.
My view has always been, and the last 9 months I've been in Washington has confirmed it even more, health care should be a civil right in this country, not something that's driving corporate profits, not something that's driving families into bankruptcy. And Washington can try to screw us over as much as it wants. This community, we're going to pull together and we're going to fight back against it.
Riley represents the largest congressional district spanning New York State. Attendees said they showed up for a range of reasons. Frank McGrath from Otsego County says he's worried about the small community health clinic in Cherry Valley at risk of closing.
So that'll be almost 2,000 patients, maybe 4,000 patient visits a year that we'll be losing. And no clinic in the surrounding areas or the hospital would be able to pick that up.
Others came for answers. Mary Page Lang Klaus from Yulin showed up because she has yet to see Riley fight for the issues people voted him in for.
We're feeling a little bit unsteady. I think he needs to get grounded and hear from us about, you know, what's important, health care and just other issues that we want him to do better for us.
And today's, town hall is very focused on health care, as you mentioned. Are there health care issues that are top of mind for you?
Well, at this point, most people have to travel a great distance to get health care. And some of the hospitals that are local to our area are on the chopping block. And, you know, that's a concern. You know, we need to be able to reach doctors that can service all the people in the county and not, you know, down in Middletown necessarily.
Riley co-sponsored the Rural Hospital Stabilization Act in August. It's bipartisan legislation to provide $500 million in emergency support to rural hospitals struggling to stay open after the cuts. Stephen Kelly, CEO of Ellenville Regional Hospital and one of the evening's panelists, says rural hospitals like Ellenville Regional will be hit the hardest once federal cuts kick in.
70% of our revenues and patients are either recipients of Medicaid or are our seniors who are collecting or have Medicare. They're not really collecting it. It gets paid to us. So both of those programs are being cut, and pretty substantially. And the place that really gets cut the most are hospitals, because hospitals have to take care of anyone who can make it to our door, whether they can pay or not. And so I think that this bill will put hospitals, particularly in rural areas like ours, at great peril, because when people come to us and they're not able to pay for their care because they're no longer insured or underinsured, that will create bad debt. And there's really no way for that to be supported in the long run.
New York Senator Peter Oberacker also announced on Monday he would run against Riley in 2026 for the 19th District's congressional seat. In a press release, Riley's campaign manager, Maddie Summers, said that Oberacker has been, quote, selling out upstate New York for years, end quote. Riley's visit to Sullivan County didn't come without some pushback. Eric Feinblatt was one of a handful of attendees outside SUNY Sullivan holding a silent protest before doors even opened. He and others held baby doll figurines wrapped in white cloth to represent the more than 20,000 children killed by Israel since the start of Israel's war in Gaza.
We're here because we're appalled by Josh Wiley's specifically visit to Israel, which we think was just a propaganda campaign. We're appalled that he's accepted money from AIPAC, and we're appalled that he doesn't stand up for any kind of Palestinian rights or sovereignty and is, frankly, complicitous in a genocide.
Inside the gymnasium, tensions ran high when Shenango County resident Francesca Testi asked Riley why he hadn't supported halting arms shipments to Israel.
Trust him on health care if you can't trust him to stand up to AIPAC. When the really tough bills go through, he is going to crumble if he's crumbling on this, which is such an easy question. Why is the United States supporting a genocide? For God's sakes, that's ridiculous.
Riley later responded with his stance on the war, but he didn't answer whether he would stop supporting sending arms to Israel.
We have to come out of this with a real plan that allows Palestinians and Israelis to live side by side in peace and with security, because at the end of the day, that is all anybody wants. So we need a ceasefire, we need humanitarian assistance in, we need the hostages out, and we've got to get a way where folks can live in peace and security with each other. I appreciate the question, Kevin. Thank you.
Riley fielded other questions top of mind for attendees, like what rural residents should do when ICE comes to town.
This is a sort of thing in our immigration system that I don't see this as a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. This is just an issue of, do you represent rural America and represent dairy farmers? And folks who do, like me, want to see that immigration reform fixed so that our farmers can get access to the labor they need, and people who are working their tails off milking the cows can go to sleep at night knowing they're going to be able to get up and go to work the next day.
Sullivan County's Commissioner of Community Resources and one of the evening speakers, Laura Quigley, urged that access to health care is just one piece of the puzzle. Affordability is another.
So if you are in an apartment right now, you have seen rents go from $800 to $1,200, $1,200 to $1,600, and your wages did not follow suit. At the same time, and I just want to just think in your head of a very fragile house of cards. So you have housing costs that have gone up. We have people working two and three jobs. I have staff that work two and three jobs in order to make ends meet. You have food crisis. You have a food crisis here because not cost of food has gone up. We still have food deserts in this county. We had coming cuts to the SNAP program. It's going to hurt an awful lot of people, most of whom are working or elderly.
That includes keeping up with skyrocketing utility bills many residents were hit with this past year. Riley announced in July he would formally intervene on behalf of ratepayers in the NYSEG rate case, fighting back against increasing utility bills.
And whether it's NYSEG or Central Hudson or National Grid, this is exactly what I'm talking about. You look at what's happening right now with utility bills across upstate New York. I have talked to so many folks who are making really difficult decisions about whether to pay the utility bill or pay for the groceries they need.
Riley chatted with local leaders and constituents for 2 hours Monday evening. But some attendees, like Wurtsboro resident Janet Davis, still left with skepticism. She said she was disappointed with the small turnout and walked away with more questions than answers.
They had so many chairs set up and not even half of them were filled. He did mention a couple of pieces of legislation that I thought were good. I think, unfortunately, he spent an awful lot of time rehashing things that we already know. We've all noticed that Representative Riley is trying very hard to reach across the aisle and work bipartisanly. I'm kind of skeptical about that, and I think I'm all for compromise and collaboration, but I am not sure in this instance if that's really going to be fruitful and really benefit his constituents in this particular climate. I'm not sure if that's the best tactic to be taking.
In Lock Sheldrick, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a break. When we come back, Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio speaks with Ulster County's election commissioners about their planning for the upcoming November elections and the voting news you need to know. This is Radio Catskill.
Coming up on WCNY's The Capitol Press Room, we'll check in with the new watchdog for the state's public authorities all over New York, and we'll also consider the fate of a large swath of land in the Adirondacks that conservationists hope that New York State officials will go to bat to preserve. All that and much more, wherever you download, stream, or tune in to WCNY's The Capitol Press Room, this afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Early voting in New York kicks off October 25th. And to help residents get ready, Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio is speaking with folks around the area today. He's speaking with Ulster County's Board of Elections Commissioners Ashley Torres and John Quigley about what's new this year, where to vote early, and how every ballot in person, by mail, or provisional is verified and counted.
Talking to Ashley Torres and John Quigley, commissioners for the Board of Elections for Ulster County. Welcome both to the show. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having
us. Thanks for having us.
So let's just start off here. What we're asking all the Board of Elections people that we speak to, what does exactly the Board of Elections handle with Ulster County on a day-to-day basis during the election season?
Yeah, sure. So during the election season, we are a staff that is very busy. We have full-time staff members here. We are a staff of 14, serving 144,000 registered voters here for Ulster County. The day-to-day, and as we get closer to the election, we are issuing absentee ballots and vote-by-mail ballots. We are canvassing those twice a week, getting them ready for election night reporting. We are also testing voting systems, so the machines that will be out for early voting and on election day. We have test ballots, so we're right now making sure that the machines, once they are out in just a couple of weeks, that they're going to work properly when they're out at the poll sites. We are training election inspectors right now that work the poll sites. We have lots of classes. We have a little over 650 election inspectors, so part-time workers, and they come to a 2.5-hour, 3-hour training class that John and I teach them. So we've been doing that. And yeah, we're just getting ready, doing things like this, getting the word out about the election, talking to voters that have questions, and just trying to let people know that they have an election this year. It's a local election year, so it doesn't get as much attention. Thank you for having us, because this definitely is amplifying that message.
Yeah, usually hyper-local events, elections don't get a lot of turnout there. Well, I'm going to ask you this, John. What does a successful election day look like from your perspective?
A successful election day looks like all of our inspectors showing up promptly at 5:15 in the morning to make sure that our poll sites get opened and operating by 6 a.m. As one of the states that has the longest election day in all of America, from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m., we have to make sure we have ample staffing and readiness to basically respond to anything that can happen on election day, whether it be those small power outages, a grumpy voter at a poll site, or just making sure that they have the water to get through a hot summer day like we did this past summer. We service those poll sites to make sure from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. they are giving voters the best voting experience possible. And in Ulster County, they get to leave with a very lovely I voted sticker that was designed by a student. So we hope that when they go to vote, they have a good experience based on the work we've put in prior to training our inspectors and getting them there to make sure everything operates in a smooth manner. Otherwise, we're here collecting results at 9 o'clock, waiting for those poll sites to close down and return the material back to us. And by about 10:30, 11, we'll hopefully be walking out the door knowing what 99% of the rest of the community will know, which is what those votes will look like.
Just take a look. We've talked a little bit off air here about some changes that made to polling locations this year. Ashley, do you want to talk about one of the ones that we talked about, Marble? It looks like their location is changing this year.
Yes. So for early voting starting October 25th, Ulster County has 6 early voting sites that we put around the county. And for early voting, any voter in Ulster County can go to any of those 6 poll sites. So we have had the same 6 sites open for the last couple of years. I would just encourage people to go to voteulster.com to get information on our early voting locations. One of those locations did change recently from the Marlborough Community Center. That site will not be open for early voting. Instead, voters will be going to the Highland American Legion. So that was a change. They booked it for some other use, and we found out about it, and we had to move the site.
Yeah. John, go back to you here. You mentioned that this is a local, hyper-local election. While there's not a big turnout, there's a lot of races happening throughout the county. Legislature of county seats or town board seats are up for grabs. With so many local races on the ballot this year, what is the biggest challenges you think can face the board coming into this election?
So with local elections and lower turnouts, sometimes means just a slower work process for not only our inspectors, but our employees. And sometimes when we go slower, we have a tendency of making more mistakes. And so with that, we just make sure we pay extra attention to the details so that when we're checking our voters in, we're correct. We're selecting the correct voter. We're not in a rush. We're providing the best service that we can. The challenges more so in a local year is that we are working with more candidates because there are numerous candidates on the local ballots that are just trying to get educated on the process. And Ashley and I become a really good extension for them to reach out and understand what it actually takes for our local elected officials to run for office. Just being a candidate, it's something that we honestly, I don't think we give them the respect for running for office to understand that process. They dive in without even knowing. It's like there's a blindfold that gets pulled off as soon as they say yes to voting, to running for office. And then next thing you know, they're like, I didn't sign up for this. You have to just walk them through and say, look, you signed up for the right reasons. You wanted to run for office. You wanted to give your community a choice and be able to explain your perspective on things. And that's probably one of the coolest things about our job, is just being able to share that journey with these candidates and being able to provide the voters with a good voting experience to step up and select who they want to support.
Yeah, definitely. Ashley, you mentioned the early voting dates. You want to go over some of those early voting dates that are happening, the times?
Of course.
But what we need to know for this election?
Yeah, so early voting, again, it's going to start on Saturday, October 25th. That day is also what we call in the election biz Golden Day. And so that means it is a very special day for us. It is the last day for anyone to register to vote to participate in this year's election. So our early voting sites also serve as a place for voters to register and cast a ballot if they have not been registered here prior to that date. So it's a very important date for us on the calendar. It's our registration cutoff dates. Folks can go to early voting sites and do that and vote on the spot, or they could submit their registration form that day and then vote in the resulting the rest of the 9 days, and of course also on election day. So that's a big day for us, October 25th. We'll be open that day from 9 to 5. Generally speaking, our early voting days are all 9 to 5, with the exception of Tuesday the 28th and Thursday the 30th. On those 2 days, on Tuesday and Thursday, we are open from 12 noon to 8 p.m., so a little bit later in the day. So the election law requires that we have 2 later nights that go until 8 o'clock. So we've historically in Ulster County had those on Tuesday and Thursday. The other dates are 9 to 5. Our 6 early voting sites around Ulster County, I'll start off with the Olive in the town of Olive, the American Legion right off of 28 in Chocan. In Kingston, our site is at the Midtown Neighborhood Center on Broadway. In Ellenville, we have the Public Library open. In New Paltz, we have the New Paltz Community Center. In Highland, that's the new site, Highland American Legion. And then in Saugerties at the Saugerties Senior Center, that's in the Cantine Field Complex. So again, all of those 6 sites, any voter, regardless of where they live in Ulster County, can go to any of those 6 sites to cast their ballot. The way that works is that when you sign in, you have your ballot made for you on demand. So as you're signing in and affixing your signature on the poll pad, it then communicates to the printer and prints the ballot that is for your town, where you live, so that you're voting for all of your very localized contests this year. So your town offices in the city of Kingston, it's as localized as your ward. So your alderman for your specific ward that you live in. And of course, the different county legislative offices that overlap in all of those towns, we want to make sure we give the voter the contest for where they live. So that's how we do it during early voting. We make them as they sign in, and then they get their ballot for where they live. Even if I live in Kingston, I could vote in New Paltz, not as close to Kingston as where I live in Hurley, and I'm going to get my ballot for my town and the contest reflected correctly.
Yeah, that makes, I'm sure that makes it very convenient for folks, especially with their busy schedules, to go out there and vote.
Absolutely. Very easy. And people have been using it more and more. It's become a very popular program.
Yeah, but that was going to be my follow-up question. Do you see people using it, utilizing the early voting more and more?
We do. In Ulster County, we can brag about this. We are one of the highest in the state early voting participating counties. So we all have internally all the different counties. We have a little competition who can be the number one for turnout. And we are either always consistently either number one or number two behind Columbia County. So those are our biggest rivals. Another Catskills County is Columbia, and we're always trading back and forth who's going to be number one. So hopefully it's us this year. So any of your listeners listening, go out and vote. No matter how you vote, that's part of that competition. We want to be the best.
The early voting starts on October 25th. John, I just want to go back to you real quick. You mentioned at the end of the night, you're collecting the votes, tallying the seat. How actually the votes are collected? Because now I'm assuming everything is digital. No one's actually physically coming to you to give you the votes. They are sent digitally to you?
So we can't have them sent digitally. That would require putting the results on a network ahead of time. And everything we do in our voting process is to ensure the integrity of the process. So it's actually that we wait from 9 o'clock for a USB stick that has the memory of the election results on it to be driven back from that poll site to our office. And the whole process is secure because it is essentially a lock and key method that we have to audit as the process goes, that it gets back to us. We plug it into a system that is completely offline so that we can upload the results in a safe and secure manner. And then we download those results from that independent system and bring it into a network system. So that takes a bit of a process. It's not right away. And I think a lot of people think, oh, at 9 o'clock, we're going to see the results right away. There's definitely time that goes by from 9 o'clock until we get to the final results. And honestly, in Ulster County, that's typically we get to about 90%, if not higher, reporting by about 10, if not 10:30.
Now, the early voting, is that automatically calculated coming 9 o'clock? Is that already those results will be showing?
So early voting and the absentee or early vote by mail ballots are usually the quickest results that get to go up by 9 o'clock because we get to then at 9 get access to those results and upload those directly. So when you see election results right away, especially all across New York State at 9 o'clock, you're usually seeing people who are reporting their early voting and vote by mail ballots.
Yeah, absolutely. Ashley, just one more question here before we go here. What is the process if there is a close rate or a recount is triggered?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked me this question because it's something that we have often have to misspell and or dispel misinformation about this. People think that if the election is not close, that we don't count the ballots that come after Election Day that get mailed a bit later. We absolutely do. Those all get factored in. So if there is a close election on election night, there will be some amount of ballots that are mailed in that are postmarked by election day that are valid and able to be counted. So we do have a longer time frame to factor those in. Every day after the election, we're opening and adding more votes to the totals as more valid ballots arrive through the mail. We also have another bucket of ballots that are cast on election day at the poll sites called affidavit ballots. Sometimes they're called provisional ballots. Those are essentially ballots that are cast by voters that have something on their record that needs fixing. So maybe they're inactive because their mail is not being sent to the right place. They show up at a poll site. They're going to get to vote that day, but they're going to do it on a provisional affidavit ballot. So we look at those, we verify them, and then we count those. This year, it's going to be on November 10th when we count those ballots. So those votes get added in. Let's say all of that's done. We count all of the post-election ballots, absentees, mail-in, and those affidavit ballots, and it's still close, and there's still maybe a tie or a really close margin. We have in New York State automatic hand counts that happen when contests fall into specific thresholds. So there's percentage thresholds, and then there's also straight number of vote thresholds. So if a contest is within 20 votes, we're counting that all of the paper, everything that was cast either on a machine or through the mail, we're looking at that. We're making sure that all of the systems we use to tabulate and count the ballots, that it did it correctly. So that is what we'll do. If we have any close elections, we will look at everything. It's the nice thing about working in a state that has paper ballots is that we have that to go back and look at and able to verify it and count it. We've had recounts in Ulster County longer than anybody else in the state because we had a local law that also required this before the state passed theirs. So we are very good at doing hand recounts in Ulster County. We can get all of our county ballots recounted in anywhere from 5 to 7 days, work days. We'll get them all counted and verify who ultimately won and lost. And that's how we'll certify our elections. It's a lengthy process, but it's an open process. We are transparent. We invite people to come and watch us do hand counts. We invite them to come and test the machines right now. All of the things that we do are open to the public. Anybody can come and see what how it works, how the sausage gets made, as they say.
Well, that's great that folks can do that, come up and do that. Ashley and John, before we go, is there anything else that I've missed that you want folks to know about?
Yeah, I would just want to emphasize, piggybacking on what Ashley said, the unique thing about Ulster is like, or New York, I should say, is we can never deny somebody the right to vote. We always have to have an avenue in which somebody can go to a poll site and cast a ballot. So if anybody ever feels like they're denied that opportunity, they should reach out to the local county board of election on election day to voice that concern that they can go and find out how to have a ballot cast. And then from there, that's what our affidavit method is for. We get to work after the election to verify and resolve any issues that might come up for a voter in their voting experience. But because it's New York State and the way we have this, you're never denied that opportunity. Make sure your voice is heard because it's one that we guarantee for everybody.
Again, thank you so much. We're talking to Ashley Torres and John Quigley, Board of Election Commissioners for the upcoming election in Ulster County, and early voting starts on October 25th. Again, thank you so much, Ashley and John. I do really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was Patricio Rubio speaking to the Ulster County Elections Commissioners, Ashley Torres and John Quigley. A reminder that you can find election coverage from us, the interviews, and also election resources at our Radio Catskill election page. Just go to wjffradio.org. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, local community members coming together just to talk and connect. Wow, go figure. This is Radio Catskill.
Hey there, Jason Dole here asking you to help Radio Catskill kick off our fall fun drive in person at the Double Down on Radio Catskill event 2 to 5 Sunday afternoon at the Arnold House. Free admission, fun games for kids and adults, tunes by DJ Tikka Masala, delicious hors d'oeuvres, cash bar, and your chance to win great prizes from local businesses. It's Double Down on Radio Catskill Sunday afternoon at the Arnold House up on Chandelier in Livingston Manor. I'll see you there.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, we've spoken to our friend Judy Balaban of the Committee for Equity and Justice recently about her group committed to creating space for honest conversation and shared understanding and collective action. There's a new group in the area, Take Time to Talk, offering time and space to gather, meet, and listen. Both of the groups are here today, Judy Balaban of the Committee for Equity and Justice, and also Eric Feinblatt and Caroline Bailey are here from Time to Talk. Hi to all of you.
Hi.
Hi there.
And we brought you both together because you both wanted to come in and talk about your talking, but also about how there are these opportunities in our community for folks to do that. Judy, I want to start with you. You have your monthly gatherings of the community for Committee for Equity and Justice. And this other group who's next to you here popped up as well. What do you think is happening here in our area with folks just wanting to get together and connect?
I think we're realizing what we need to do to bridge the divide that we're feeling. I'm hopeful that that's what's happening. And I think those of us who are participating in these conversations recognize that it's helping. I went to the talk yesterday in Calicoon that Eric and Carolyn are, you know, have gotten together. And it was wonderful. I met people, and I met people that I have known. And during the conversation, things came up that we have so much in common. I mean, one of the gentlemen lives across the street from where I grew up. He's been there for 30 years. And I see him all the time. I never knew that. And okay. Connecting with each other is so important. We're losing that.
Eric and Carolyn, you mentioned Time to Talk. It's happening every Tuesday in Calicoon. You've had a couple of these sessions last night, the most recent one. What are you hearing and feeling about this? And then why did you decide to start this meeting?
Oh, you know, there's so much noise now. And to respond to it, We tend to have lost our humanity. I think that that's the biggest issue. And we don't know what it's like just to sit down and talk with each other about things that are important and things that are insignificant. And last night was a really good example of what it's like to get to gather with a group of people and talk about what brought you here to this community. And then all the peregrinations, where you were born, where you left and how you ended up here and all the roadblocks to it and the crazy things that happened in between. It was really fun. And we just laughed together. And for a second or for an hour and a half, we just were kind of outside the viciousness of the news cycle.
Mm-hmm. And you say you promote Time to Talk as a time to space, a time and space to gather with no agenda and no program. What kinds of things are bubbling up to the surface for people that they want to talk about? Can you give us an example of last night or recent conversations?
Yeah, last night was so fun because everybody started talking about travel and where they had traveled to. But I think the best was when one person said, what about what was the most stupid thing you did whilst traveling? I'm not going to repeat what I said because that would be just too embarrassing. But the nice thing was that we could really share with each other these these moments in our lives. And I learned something about my husband, Eric, that I didn't know before. And I think that bonding, that connecting, finding out meaning about each other, that's something that I've been really missing. I've only been here 8 years. And I found, you know, during the pandemic and, you know, I know lots of people, but I don't know them.
And I think that's really an interesting point, too. And Judy, you mentioned that as well about your neighbor who you've seen across the street for 30 years, but didn't necessarily know that much about him. And we all sort of encounter that here in our community. We know a lot of people. You'll see a lot of people at the bank or the farmer's market, but you may not really know them. And so these are opportunities to get to understand them a little bit more. Judy, they at Time to Talk have maybe no program or no agenda. At your monthly meetings, you do have a topic that you try to present. Is that right?
We do have a topic. And
how does that help get to know someone better and get feel that conversation?
To a certain extent, a big part of the purpose is to get to know ourselves better, because we take a look at the topic and we try to understand where our perspective comes from. Is it our upbringing? Is it the traveling we've done? Is it the books we've read? And that helps us understand that somebody else's perspective, who might be totally different, is valid. It's not necessarily right or wrong. And people frequently come back and they say, you know, when I left it the last month, I couldn't sleep because I kept thinking about all of these ideas and things. And then we also try to ask people to look at the facts and, you know, go research what you've heard to find out, is that true? And the difficulty is, you know, facts are depending upon where you get your facts. But it makes your brain pause and think about what you're hearing and what you're thinking. Is it real? Is it true? Wait a minute. Let me do some more research. Let me try to understand the other person and where they're coming from. So that's been really helpful for a lot of people who are coming.
You have another monthly meeting coming up. Tell folks about the topic at this one and yes. Where and when.
So tomorrow at 6 o'clock at the Ethel Burt B. Crawford Library.
I just say E.B. Crawford.
Okay. right. In Monticello, the topic will be to think about the insecurity our immigrant neighbors are feeling and how that affects them and our community at large.
And that's E.B. Crawford Library in Monticello. You guys have another meeting coming up on Tuesday. Again, no agenda, no program. But are there ideas or topics that you think you might want to introduce? Or are you kind of leaving it open to the group?
Really, no.
Yeah.
I mean, we really – it's modeled off something called open space. And it's just whoever comes –
Tell us a little more about
that. Whoever comes – well, Caroline can talk more about that because she uses that quite a bit in facilitation that she does.
So it's basically the idea, whoever comes are the right people, and whatever happens is the right thing to happen. And so it's very organic.
And this is every Tuesday. You started recently. Do you intend to continue this on for the time being, or is there a project for the fall?
Yeah, we're going to continue it as long as it's warm enough in the depot. And then, you know, different people have said, oh, when it gets too cold, can you come to our house or can you go to Jeffersonville or how about the church? We're going to see what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, we want it to continue. I think the nice thing about it is it's become sort of a ritual. Every Tuesday, you know, you can come between 5:30 and 7. There'll be food there. We're going to ask people to make it sort of a potluck. Mm-hmm. And you can just show up and something will be going on. And you can sit silently as an observer, or you can just participate when you want to participate.
This seems like something that maybe is a tradition that was lost and is now being recovered here. What do you think about this moment is causing it to bubble back up? I think you've alluded to it, but.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, Caroline always talks about, because she's English, talks about the village pub. Uh-huh. And the idea that something is there, it's open, people just go there, they hang out, and they speak with each other, and they enjoy the conversation that doesn't usually end up with fisticuffs. We want to – I'm not going to say we're going to emulate it, but maybe the inspiration is from that, just a place that you can come and gather and speak and eat and enjoy each other's company and explore things that you probably wouldn't have the opportunity to explore in other situations.
Find more common ground than you may have realized, or just know more about that neighbor you've been waving to for the last 30 years. I have the same thing. tell folks where you can go and get more information and when the next event's coming up.
So it's Tuesday, every Tuesday at 5:30 in the depot. We will make an announcement on Facebook if we change the location, but that won't be for another 3 weeks.
Right. So every Tuesday, and you know, bring some food with you. Yeah. Bring a sweater. It's exactly. Cool, and yeah. Enjoy the company of other people.
Thank you guys for doing this in both the different ways, with a topic to instigate conversation, with a more organic conversation, just having the conversations and making connections, right? Thank you all.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Judy Thank Balaban, you.
Judy Balaban of the Committee for Equity and Justice, and Eric Feinblatt and Carolyn Bally of Take Time to Talk. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, our Hispanic Heritage Month series continues with a conversation from the host of Latino USA. This is Radio Chatskill.
I've talked to folks who were in graduate programs in New York who are like amazing qualified computer programmers, quants even, and they say like, you know, I had like 400 interviews this semester. I can't even get an internship because it's all full of AI screens.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. If you want to better understand a future that's already here, please contribute now. Here's how.
Make your donation now at wjffradio.org. Thanks.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and Radio Chatskill is continuing its Hispanic Heritage Month series, highlighting the culture, identity, and voices shaping our region and beyond. This week, Patricio Rubio speaks with Maria Hinojosa, a longtime host and executive producer of Latino USA. That airs Thursdays at 2, right here on Radio Chatskill. Here's their conversation.
Maria, welcome to the show. It's a privilege to have you. I just want to first start off with asking you, what does Hispanic heritage mean to you personally, given your journey from Mexico City to growing up right here in the U.S. and the many hats you wear now as a journalist, host, author, and mentor?
Well, I have to be very honest with you because as a journalist, I only deal with truth and fact. And the truth is that I was not a big fan of Hispanic Heritage Month historically. I don't ever use the term Hispanic to refer to myself. It's not a label that I identify with. And I was always very circumspect about a month here, a month there. I would say that now, given our reality, I am a very big fan of Latino Heritage Month. I think we need to, as soon as things change in our country, go back to having massive celebrations in public, celebrating who we are and telling the truth about who we are. And to me, Hispanic Heritage Month, Latino Heritage Month at this point in the United States of America in 2025 has to be about telling the truth about who we are as a people. Because for basically a decade, the Republican Party, sadly, and Donald Trump have created a narrative about us that is not true. It is based on lies. And so we have to do the hard work to tell the truth about who we are. And your listeners need to do the hard work and research, and also to just look around them, because the Latinos and Latinas that they see in their community are not the people who this administration says we are. We're just not. So base what you are doing in your life on fact, on what you actually see in your community, as opposed to what you are hearing and being told by certain people.
How do you see the role of Latino USA in today's media landscape, especially, like you said, that the issues affecting Latino communities, both, you know, more visible and more contested?
Here's the interesting thing about Latino USA. We are 100% independent. So you can't fire us. We can't get fired because we are run by a small nonprofit newsroom called Futuro Media. And the only people that can fire us are actually our supporters, your listeners. And Latino USA has been on the air since 1993. And we have built an extraordinary cache of people who turn to us for the integrity, for the deep journalism, for the human reporting, for journalism with heart, for fact-based journalism. And so I never thought that I would say this, but Latino USA and Futuro Media, we are part of the crusade against mis- and disinformation. Journalists, we just like to be journalists. We don't want to be activists. We don't want to be advocates. We don't want to be, you know, we want to do our job as journalists. The truth is now our job as journalists for Latino USA is that we are combating mis- and disinformation, and that has become one of our roles. And we take it very seriously. And more importantly, the trust that we have from our audience is something that we value. And that's why we're able to be on the air. So we take our role and responsibility very seriously. At the same time, we don't only want to do journalism that is sad and depressing and only talks about Latinos as immigrants, because, you know, many of us, I'm in California right now, they are not immigrants. The border crossed them. This was originally Mexico. Our role and responsibility is also to bring the serious investigative reporting, but also bring humor, joy, laughter, culture. And that's what we do. And we get a lot of love from the community because of it.
Now, you did mention, you know, the misrepresentation of Latinos. You know, over the decades you've been reporting, you know, what have been some of the biggest changes you witnessed in how the Latino community is represented or misrepresented in media, politics, and, you know, the general public discourse?
Well, that in and of itself would take several hours, if not days, to understand the level of mis- and disinformation that has spread about who we are. Now, Latinos and Latinas, it used to be that we were just invisible, that people just didn't see us. We have moved into hyper-visibility now, but the hyper-visibility is not to say, oh my God, we're going to recognize all of the incredible things that Latinos and Latinas do for the United States, i.e., we are in the top five. If we were measured as a gross domestic product, we're in the top five in the world. We are trillions upon trillions of dollars of economic growth and base in this country. Our median age is about 11 years old. We're the youngest population, which means we're going to grow, and it means we're going to have extraordinary impact and effect on this country. Everything about us is about the future of the United States. And yet, we are at a point where we're having to beat back lies. I'm on my way to Los Angeles right now. I just left Chicago this week. These are two cities that are happily Latino and Latina. And yet, both of these cities have become a target and a focus of an unnecessary militarized style attack on human beings, where the Supreme Court has sadly said, well, yes, if they look Mexican, if they look brown and they're working in a low skilled, low wage labor job, you can stop them. This is horrible. And our entire country should be worried about what happens next. It starts with Mexicans. It starts with immigrants. And here we are now with late night comics.
I always wondered, how has your identity as someone who's born in Mexico and, you know, raised in the U.S. and someone who lives between different cultures shaped the kind of stories you choose to tell on Latino USA?
Well, we have a team of journalists, and so it's not just me. Mm-hmm. It's my newsroom that makes these decisions. And we're just very curious. I mean, the reality is that Mexicanos, Mexican-American people in the United States are the majority. We are very influential. I'm in California right now on a reporting trip. 30% of all Latinos and Latinas in the United States live in the state of California. So the Mexican dynamic, Mexican immigrants in particular, have a very important dynamic, which we have to tell and which we have been telling. But I live in New York. New York is a city where, for a long time, the Puerto Rican population was the majority. Then Dominican people came from the Caribbean. Now, the group that is being deported most out of New York City, or not even deported, removed, deported means you have had some kind of due process. The people being most removed are from Ecuador. So our job at Latino USA is to be very curious about how the Latino and Latina population in our country continues to change and evolve. And that, I think, is we do it well because we are very flexible, we're fluid, and because we're good journalists who have our feet on the ground. But we know that the Latino and Latina population in the United States is extraordinarily complex. We're just scratching the surface, and yet we're the ones doing probably some of the best work in terms of understanding this in English.
Now, just talking about it, the evolving, you know, Latino community, you know, just looking ahead here, how do you envision Latino USA evolving in format or reach or mission, you know, to meet the needs of a changing Latino community, especially, like you mentioned, with younger generations?
I think one of the things that we understand we have to do is actually double down on what we have always done, which is excellent reporting, excellent audio journalism, excellent storytelling. We don't shy away from that. We go deeper into that. That is the basis of our work. Obviously, we are already giving space to the next generation of journalists and anchors on Latino USA. You hear them on the work that we produce throughout Futuro Media. So we're conscious about always bringing in younger voices. I think, you know, the place for us to evolve, there's two. One is in social media, just understanding that we have no choice but to be in that space and be there just a little bit more deliberately. And two, in terms of making Latino USA a visual podcast, how do we record Latino USA so that people who want to see it or listen to their podcasts on YouTube can actually have that? That, I think, is our big challenge, and that would definitely grow our audience. So we just, you know, we're always evolving, and I think that's what's kept Latino USA on the air for 3 decades now.
What challenges do you see ahead for Latino communities in the U.S., you know, culturally, socially, in policy? And also, while there are many challenges, where do you see opportunities for progress?
So the Latino population in the United States is facing all of the challenges, all of them. Silverio Villegas, an undocumented Mexican man in the city of Chicago, sole parent, sole custody of his 2 children under the age of 7, was shot in his back when he was running away from ICE agents who had their face covered. So we are facing a moment in our country that is horrific. A line in the sand has been crossed. Latinos and Latinas have to understand that this is about all of us. So there's a lot of conversation that needs to happen internally among Latinos and Latinas in families where families were divided by politics, where grandparents or parents or aunts and uncles voted for Donald Trump and you had a younger generation, not necessarily. We have a lot of difficult conversations that need to be had. We have to really understand how it happened that there's an element of self-hatred here, where you could actually look at somebody who speaks with such disrespect about the community in general, and yet that we would vote in such large numbers, especially Latino men. So we have to have this conversation. At the same time, my favorite Mexican saying of all time is, no hay mal que por bien no venga. There is no bad from which good cannot come. And so this is a moment to see opportunity. You have a whole generation of young people under the age of 12 and those between the ages of, let's say, 13 to 25, who are having life-changing experiences right now. They are going to protest, or they wish they could be at the protest because they're living in fear, or they are, you know, finding themselves in libraries trying to be safe from La Migra, and they're reading books like my books, like Once I Was You, my memoir. They're listening to Latino USA. Their minds are opening and expanding in a way that maybe they weren't expecting to have happened at this point in their lives, but they are being forced into this moment. And so leaders are going to be born. Absolutely. There will be new, phenomenally interesting Latino and Latina leadership in the United States. This is what gives me hope, you know, that anything is possible. Just today, as we're speaking, there are now rumors that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, is planning to run for either Senate or President of the United States. So things in terms of Latinos and Latinas are rapidly changing. It is not all sadness and devastation, but at the same time, if you are a Latino and Latina with any kind of privilege, open your eyes, because this is your moment to step up for our democracy.
Thank you, Maria. Thank you for your time. We're talking to Maria Hinojosa, executive producer and host of Latina USA, that airs here on Radio Catskill Thursdays at 2 o'clock. Thank you so much for talking to me. I do really appreciate it. You don't know how much this means to me. I do really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Oh my gosh. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And long live the Catskills.
That's it for us today. Thanks for listening. On Point next.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.